This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony. Benjamin Britten learned at least two important lessons from his composition teacher, Frank Bridge. While his conservatory studies concentrated on the classics, Bridge kept steering him towards the more up-to-date scores of composers like Mahler, Schoenberg, and Stravinsky. Being exposed to modernism was critical to Britten's development, not because he ended up sounding like any of those composers, but because it gave him the tools to move in his own direction, away from the English pastoral tradition of Elgar and Vaughan Williams. But even though he left that composing tradition behind, other traditions remained important to him. He often used texts by classic English authors, and he wrote dozens of arrangements of authentic folk songs from the British Isles. One of Britten's most formidable achievements was being able to keep one foot in Britten's musical past while pushing boldly forward with the other. After graduating from the Royal College of Music, Britten found a job that might seem a little bizarre to us today, staff composer for the General Post Office Film Unit, writing film scores for postal-related documentaries. Now, this job turned out to be not just gainful employment, but also an aesthetic experience. One of the senior members of the department was the poet W.H. Auden, with writers like Christopher Isherwood and Montague Slater on staff. Many of them were left-wing pacifists, and several were as close to being openly gay as was possible at the time. Britten promptly began developing in both those directions. In 1939, as World War II was beginning to consume Europe, Britten left England for the United States. He had already settled into what would be a lifelong artistic and domestic partnership with the young tenor Peter Pears, who would not only be Britten's preferred leading man, but also his muse. While they were in Los Angeles, Britten found a book of poems by the early 19th century English writer George Crabbe. The poem that caught Britten's attention was The Burrow, which included the story of one Peter Grimes, a fisherman in East Anglia who was a truly bad character. He beat his father, gambled, and drank to excess. As Crabbe wrote, he fished by water and he filched by land. Grimes had a series of apprentices whom he got through a kind of slave trade in orphans at London workhouses, all of whom died through a combination of negligence and brutality. After the mayor forbade Grimes to take another apprentice and the borough ostracized him, he began to suffer from hallucinations and died insane. Britten later reported that when he read this tale, I suddenly realized where I belonged and what I lacked. Where he belonged was evidently home, and he and Pears returned to England a few weeks later. What he lacked, as a composer anyway, was a serious opera, and preferably one on an English theme. Britten and Pears developed a scenario around the tale of Peter Grimes and offered it to their old friend Christopher Isherwood to turn into a libretto. Isherwood didn't think it would make a good opera, so he turned them down. But another film unit colleague, Montague Slater, accepted, and by February 1945, the opera was finished. Peter Grimes is full of themes that would become Britten's signatures: sympathetic portrayal of a social outcast, undertones of sexual ambiguity and abuse, the corruption of innocence, the moral haziness that is part of the human condition, the hypocrisy of an intolerant community given to scapegoating, and a leading tenor part crafted specifically for Pears. The score is modernist, but not atonal, using harmony both to suggest horror and to offer comfort. It's not an opera in the through-composed Wagnerian style, but more like a 19th century number opera, with arias, ensembles, and choruses all balanced into the dramatic flow. And it's an opera rooted in place, The fictional village setting is much like the seaside town of Aldeburgh, which would become Britain's home. Claustrophobic, provincial, and English to the core. The opera opens at an inquest into the death of a boy named William Spode, who was apprenticed to the fisherman Peter Grimes. The coroner calls various witnesses, including Grimes himself, and returns a verdict of death in accidental circumstances. The villagers are upset. They regard Grimes as a violent criminal who needs to go. And when Grimes' only friend, the schoolmistress Ellen Orford, brings him another apprentice from the workhouse, they become openly hostile. Ellen befriends the new boy, John, but is later horrified to find evidence of mistreatment on his body. She challenges Peter, and he strikes her. And while the pub landlady and her nieces are sympathetic, the men of the village march to Grimes' hut to confront him. But the hut is empty. Minutes before they arrived, the new apprentice had fallen to his death over the cliff edge, and Peter had climbed down after him. Grimes disappears, and the local gossip stirs the village into action again. The entire borough, minus Ellen and a retired sea captain named Balstrode, form a manhunt. While they chase after him, Grimes turns up on shore, where he meets the captain. The events have driven him mad, and Balstrode suggests that his only way out is to sink himself and his boat at sea. As dawn breaks the next day, the village has returned to normal life, and when a report comes in of a ship going down, it's dismissed as a mere rumor. The opera was scheduled to open at London's Sadler's Wells Company less than a month after the war ended in Europe, and the production period was so difficult that Britain and Pears never worked with Sadler's Wells again. The orchestra and chorus felt that the music was a piece of cacophony and were openly hostile to Pears in Britain for having been conscientious objectors during the war. Many others were upset because they felt that what was needed at the end of the war was something frothy, or at least something familiar, rather than a dark and challenging new work. But opening night was a huge success. After a moment of stunned silence, the audience erupted. There were 14 curtain calls and 8 more sold-out performances. By the end of 1948, Peter Grimes had had 19 staged productions and 2 radio productions in a dozen countries, and Britain had turned several of the opera's orchestral passages into a suite that he called 4 Sea Interludes, as a reminder of the critical role that the sea plays in the lives of the characters. Britain would go on to write 10 more operas, but Peter Grimes is the one with the secure place on the world stages, and the one by which all 20th century opera can be measured. This is Rick Malone for the San Francisco Symphony.